There's a lyric that's coming into my head from a band called Spoon, and it goes something like, "You got no fear of the underdog. That's why you're not going to survive." And I think it's this idea that a large company right. gets blinded by smaller, fast-moving companies that, with a disruptive, in this case, technology that could cut them out, you know, could cut their legs out from underneath. That's what's so shocking, is that
right.
We haven't seen any shakeup like this or potential shakeup like this in a long time.
Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast, presented by the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional go-to-market executive in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a marketing executive in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to discuss all things in high-tech marketing.
We share our own experiences running marketing teams with a special focus on early-stage technology startups. Our successes, our failures, what worked and what didn't. We'll also be inviting our CMO friends and other marketing colleagues onto the show every once in a while. And hopefully we will impart some wisdom along the way. Peter Farrago, the man. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. At work, I put out a new homepage in record time. Basically did it in 3 or 4 days, like a pretty massive change with a new product and new positioning. How is life for you?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah. Not much new to report. Doing work with some startups and doing the typical thing. A couple of them are looking for funding. So pulling out my Rolodex and doing that. I just find that a big part of my life has just been asking for money, Peter, from investors to donors for nonprofits I work with, to customers asking them to buy my products or services. And I never really occurred to me that probably a third of my life has consisted of nothing but asking other people to give me money. And it's friggin' exhausting, you know? But I'm good at it at this point. You know, I've developed a lot of gall. At this one nonprofit I'm working for, we're approaching a billionaire, and seeing if this individual won't, donate to the cause. But, you know, I have, at this point in my life, I've got, you know, mostly gray hairs at this point. I it doesn't bother me at all. You know, I mean, 30 years ago, I would have been a bit trepidatious about even considering doing this. Now I'm so good at asking other people for their money that I'm just like, whatever, you know, just walk into the room and do it. So I've developed this skill set.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a leadership dilemma, right? Like if you're trying to influence what people do or prioritize or causes you get behind, and, you know, it takes resources and it takes money, and, you know, you're trying to influence people for the means to get things done.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Well, and it's also the mutual exchange of something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, wow, this week, fun topic. It's leading off with a title that's one of my favorite sayings ever. I've mentioned it on this podcast many times. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Yep.
And especially for us marketing folks, and you phrase this beautifully, Peter, many times about how, you know, our real job is we're not looking at this quarter or the next quarter. We're also looking at, we are looking at those, but we're also looking at the third quarter and the fourth quarter and the fifth quarter, you know, what's coming down the pike, because we've got to make sure that when we get there, there's going to be demand and that we're going to be feeding the more executional parts of the company, sales, customer success, or whatever, the demand they need to meet the revenue goals of the company, not just near term, but over, the horizon. And so by definition, we have to put together a plan. Not necessarily a long-term plan, but at least a year, right? to ensure that that demand is there. But the thing with plans is that when you start executing them, all of a sudden you get punched in the mouth many times. And the metaphor I always use too is the fog of war, right? You can be in the command and control center all you want, but once your troops on the front lines are in the fog of war, you know, everything starts to blow up and you have to be fast on your feet. So this is relevant again, especially in early stage startups where the punches to the mouth are every hour, right? Because it's a highly competitive environment. I mean, you know, there's always
the hourly beatings.
They will continue until morale improves, right? So anyway, I love this topic. I think it's a great topic. What are your thoughts?
Definitely. I love that phrase too. I mean, I sort of think of it as like, you know, and you know, you make your plans and you think about it in a perfect world, quote unquote, and then reality strikes. And, you know, you can come in and hype yourself up. I think also Tyson used to say that as kind of a warning to his opponent, like, you know, you think you're going to come in and do X, Y, and Z, but I'm here too. And you're going to have to change your plan because of me.
Yeah. I mean, and this notion has been around forever. You know, there's the old saying, man makes plans and God laughs. So that's another way
to put
it.
Or the best laid plans of mice and men.
Right.
I mean, this is so obvious, but no one can predict the future. You can make your, everything is a hypothesis, a guess, like you hope it's going to work out. And you have to be, I guess, flexible and adaptable, I suppose. You know, we're trying to say, yeah, we're going to get this many leads and this much revenue pipeline and this much whatever. And then you get, you know, you get into it and it's not working out. So that sucks too. It's hard. It's hard when the results you think you're going to get aren't there. You know, if I'm talking to somebody starting in their career, and Sheryl Sandberg actually had a famous, I think it was a commencement speech where she talked about the need to stay open. She went from, I guess, a government career, DC career to like joining Facebook at the time, and just could never have foreseen in 10 years her life would change so much and what she did for work would change so much, and that consumer behavior and social networking, like all these things were unpredictable, I guess, is what she was saying, is what I also think and what I tell people. It's like, yeah, you got to stay open, be willing to adapt, be a lifelong learner, be curious. It's all the things you hear, but this is like the flip side. It's like, well, this is why you have to be adaptable and roll with it, right? Roll with the punches, right, as they say. I guess there's a lot of sayings around this topic. That's what I'm gathering.
Well, so, you know, when you're putting together a go-to-market plan, right, you're strategizing how to bring a product to market, and you're defining target audiences and positioning and channels and sales strategy, and you're trying to do the product market fit thing and see where it works. But Murphy's Law just eats that shit for lunch.
You actually merged two. You put eating, you know, some the concept of someone eating your lunch and eating shit, you put it together. That was masterful.
Yeah, thank you.
but you're right. Like from a go-to-market plan, I mean, we're talking about a very specific type of planning in a company, go-to-market. I've mentioned this before. Often salespeople call themselves go-to-market, but go-to-market is actually inclusive of marketing, sales, and typically business development, not prospecting like BDR, business development reps, but like business development partnerships, large complex partnerships with other companies and ecosystem players. But it's all this outboundy type sets of, it's everything but say product and engineering and some administrative stuff. That whole, how do you go to market, get people interested in and aware of, and then sell them your product and keep them using it year over year, that whole process. Everyone wants growth. You've got companies, the scoreboard is revenue, and you have to plan for it. You have to look out over the year and say, here's my go-to-market plan. I'm launching this product. The audience is this big. You know, you do some math around it, and you do some plans, and you try to claim that, yeah, I'm going to spend this amount of money to get these customers at this, you know, rate and at this cost per acquisition. And you can try to do all that, and one should, but, you know, it's going to be hard to estimate accurately, and you're going to have all kinds of things that you'll have to adjust to along the way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, I've said this to you many times, and I think I've said it on this podcast as well. I think the whole go-to-market plan or any kind of project plan is more an exercise for management to think through the problem. It's not really a thing you execute. It's just, here's possibly what we may do. And we've got, you know, we're going to go to these many events and we're going to do this many. So you've got that level of execution. Then everything's going to change and you're going to readjust it. But that thing you put together at the beginning of the year, the beginning of the quarter, and you've got in your OKRs and the whole corporation is aligned around those. Yeah. Those are going to shift and change.
Yahoo, where I was for 5 years until I joined this startup, I kind of went to a big company and then back to small company. We were $8 billion in revenue and I was doing annual planning and it is a totally different exercise. I think one of the things that you have the benefit of at a large company, though, is you have historical data and you have you have a lot to look at in terms of cost per acquisition and historical growth rates, and you've tried a lot of stuff. So it's a lot easier to say, okay, I did this for each of the last 5 years. And so next year, I think I'll do roughly in this range. And what's going to be different this year is the following, right? You're working with a lot of known information, whereas when you're doing like a first year launch in a new market, like if you're creating some kind of AI application and you're hoping to sell it to all these companies, like you have a lot more uncertainty. It's like, well, what's their appetite for AI? What's the uptake? How are we going to reach them? We don't have existing relationships. We don't have historical data from last year. There's so much that less that you know. There's so many more unknowns that the ability to predict gets a lot harder. So big companies have, on the one hand, an advantage because there's a lot of historical data, and little companies have a lot more uncertainty. So you just got to, you've got to adjust to your situation.
Yeah. Well, I think a good example of this, and we could probably bring up more, but certainly on a strategic level, Google was punched in the face by OpenAI. Right? Because they had all this generative AI and LLM stuff. They would often show it off. They had early on, was it Bard? And they just had to scramble, right? I mean, it took them a couple of years to get their stuff together to directly compete against OpenAI with Gemini. And, you know, they're still iterating very quickly. But when OpenAI was at, you know, 100 million run rate in 2 months. That growth rate has never been seen in the tech world before. Their growth rate, I think, is still unmatched. I mean, maybe there are a few companies out there now that have beat that, but just the massive scale of adoption, classic startup finding a big legacy company flat-footed and just rolling over them.
You have a company that's focused on one thing and it's a big bet on, I don't know, this new technology being able to do a lot of things and be disruptive, and that's all they're doing. Whereas, you know, a company like Google has dozens, if not more than 100 products. They have quite a lot of products. It's a big company. And also, you know, the punch in the mouth probably was maybe OpenAI predicted this idea that consumer behavior might shift so much where people were getting kind of the single click answers, right? Versus, you know, basically Google's search empire being challenged. I think that was unthinkable a couple years ago. It's only been in the last year or so people have really talked about it.
Well, I think it's a multifaceted mess still, because what has occurred to me more using ChatGPT and AI mode is that I thought I was searching Google to get an answer to a question. I wasn't. I was searching Google to get an answer to a question to solve a problem I was having. And the thing that OpenAI did was, when you put in there what you were looking for, my searches, so to speak, have completely changed to this is my problem, help me solve it, as opposed to I need an answer to this question. And that was really a major paradigm shift in my brain as to why I was going to Google search in the first place. And so as a result, you know, Google now has what they call their AI mode, which is just, I ain't searching. I'm trying to solve a problem. Here's what I'm looking for. Help me figure this out. Big AI brain in the sky. And then that just completely cocks up their business model. So this is another thing, which you said about Google having many products and many businesses. They also have many business models. Now, fortunately, Google, because it's filled with a lot of brilliant people, they appear to be riding that wave pretty well, transitioning over. I'm now paying them a monthly subscription fee, which I had never paid Google a dime except for a little bit of storage over the past year. You know, and now I'm paying them $20 a month, which I consider just this insane bargain. But my point is that they're surfing this tsunami that's coming at them very well.
Google's roots are in sort of this idea of giving away things for free on the internet and then making money from ads. And that's their DNA. And I kind of reference that because it really does, Google's more nuanced and interesting than that, of course, but everything they do, all the consumer touch points they have, all the information they derive, all the signals they scrape and pull and synthesize, they're all for allowing better targeting to against users, and it's all part of their ad, you know, their ad strategy. So that's how they make the money. Then OpenAI comes around, and I think the big shakeup, the big punch in the mouth, is that it starts sucking away traffic to Google's search page as like the first place people typically go on the internet. So it's this massive consumer behavior shift away from that
really
for the first time is
really
challenging that core business. And you're right, like the however many billions of dollars Google is, about 90% of that is ad revenue. So
it became tectonic to not just the tech industry, but all the industries that depend upon their Google ad buys and SEO, you know, SEM and SEO, to draw traffic to their websites to do business. I mean, it's not just slowly decreasing. It is nosediving and people, all kinds of businesses that normal people run, they really depend upon the web traffic that Google provided to them. Hugely damaging to these businesses.
But let's put it into some perspective. So Google, from 2020 to now, has almost doubled revenue. So they were doing a little under $200 billion in 2020. And last year, 2024, they did $350 billion. So they went from about $180 to $350. Crazy, so that's growth. Almost like if you doubled, that'd be $360. Almost like literally doubled in the last 4+ years. And that's on, you know, that's on a huge number already. So they're at $350 billion plus. They've had strong growth year over year. And you're right. Like if you look at the majority of that revenue, it is coming from Google search, YouTube ads, and subscriptions. So that is their core business. But the point is that the underlying shift is consumers now going somewhere else first. And that's the thing that's going to challenge all the search revenue. I think YouTube is still running strong, but you know, maybe that will persist and not be as challenged by, say, the LLMs. But that's the big shift, is something is sucking away the consumers to whom they show ads. And that's a big punch in the mouth. The other thing is to be a foundation lab or to be a lab or not to be a lab, right? People were looking at them and they were playing around with, I think it was Bard at the time, was sort of their engine, and they were trying to have people adopt it. And now it's been renamed Gemini. And maybe this is in response to OpenAI. Like OpenAI was moving fast and looked like they were threatening them and blah, 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 blah. And so Google wanted to look like they had some cool AI coming out too. And they did this big thing, I think, at the end of 2023. where they had kind of a big showcase of all the cool new things Bard could do. And it turned out a lot of it was on rails. It was like screenshots and it wasn't actually real technology and it was a little bit faked and mocked up. And then they got a ton of really negative PR backlash. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's now called Gemini and not Bard, because they want to separate themselves from that debacle.
From the brand,
Yeah, so there's multiple things at play. Basically, like, yes, they're growing. They're huge. That may change rapidly. I don't know what the revenue is looking like this year as a result. I'm sure it's already being affected by people going to ChatGPT and Claude.
Right. But I mean, if people are willing to pay Perplexity and Anthropic and chat, you know, OpenAI, $20 a month for this stuff, I'm sure they're going to be willing to pay Google as well and Microsoft as well. These are huge dollars and people are paying them because the value is so obvious. So,
and it's being perceived generally by analysts that Google is being perceived as navigating AI pretty well. You are subscribing to Google's AI. And I think that they have a stronghold or a moat is they have all these user relationships and people are using all the Google Docs and Gmail and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And they are able to sprinkle in AI that are sort of inserted, embedded, and woven into the user experience in the right ways. And they're also able to introduce people to their AI because so many people are using search that you now get the AI, summaries at the top of your search results. So, you know, they're slowing people, they're cannibalizing themselves in a way, I guess, from search, but they're keeping people connected to them and not letting them easily go, say, to ChatGPT.
Well, you know, I've only seen tech elephants do this. Maybe in other industry, there are elephants who are doing it. But Apple, early on, they were just doing PCs, right? Desktops and laptops. And then they moved to iPods. Music players.
Yeah.
And then they moved to phones, right? And then they have their cloud offering. And so they moved into that. And then now they've got a content business around movies. And, you know, especially obviously with the iPhone and all the accessories around that. And then crazily, headphones. I mean, it's insane the percentage of their income that comes from the AirPod lines of headphones. I mean, who would have thought? They were the first $3 trillion market cap company. And even though they were an elephant and, quote, a legacy company, they were able to shift. And I think we're seeing this with Google now. And, you know, that this is something that I think is unique to our industry is how do these giant companies, they've been able to move, to transform themselves. Super impressive. And of course, Microsoft had to do the same thing, right? I mean, they made money off selling PC operating systems and they moved into cloud. They're now selling their Copilot AI subscriptions. They moved their entire Office productivity suite to the web. This has been amazing, these transformations that these companies have gone through. And, you know, it is really incredible.
So each of these companies has quite a different way. I think we're talking a little bit about how AI might be the punch in the mouth that they're all dealing with. Each of them has an existing business and they have to think about AI through their own lens is kind of my main point.
Right.
That's my main point. Yeah. And you know, one is much more hardware consumer devices like Apple. The other one is this online search internet giant, Google, and so on. So an OpenAI, if you look at it, is an upstart, extremely well-funded, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. And they have this very shocking, jarring, you know, consumer behavior shift they're pushing. But interestingly enough, it doesn't look like Apple or Google's growth is slowing at all.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
Yeah.
And you know, we haven't even talked about Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, Meta is a different. Snapchat, I don't know as much about Meta. Yeah. I mean, Meta is WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook footprints primarily. The VR headset, did not take off. That's why they named themselves Meta for the Metaverse, by the way, if anyone, lest you forget. But they are making waves in the news, of course, by poaching sort of high visibility AI talent, like senior AI people in the industry, to go to work on Llama. I'm at an AI app company, and a lot of our stuff is built on top of Llama 3, which we are finding one of the most performant, I'll just call it an engine, even if that's not 100% accurate. So, you know, they exist in AI and they are putting a lot of resources against it for sure. I don't, you know, for that business, you've got to look at their ad revenue that they create from social networking traffic. And that's a different, yet a different business. And they have to think about how to weave in AI as a experience for their end users. And then also they have thrown their hat in the ring to be a lab and build foundational models. We have this radical shift or impact from whatever AI means. Like, AI is impacting how lots of companies can operate, both in terms of what they provide their customers in terms of value, leveraging AI, and also just the threat of being disrupted, you know?
Right, so, right. Running very scared, spending hundreds of millions of dollars for talent. They're so scared.
Yeah, look, you know, this is the innovator's dilemma, and there's a lyric that's coming into my head from a band called Spoon, and it goes something like, "You got no fear of the underdog. That's why you're not going to survive." And I think it's this idea that a large company gets blinded by smaller, fast-moving companies with a disruptive, in this case, technology that could cut them out, you know, could cut their legs out from underneath. That's what's so shocking, is that we haven't seen any shakeup like this or potential shakeup like this in a long time. This introduction of AI is so game-changing. Each of these companies obviously has to consider it from their own frame of reference, but it is so interestingly threatening.
It's a very, 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 very hard punch in the mouth. All right, Peter, let's start doing some boxing here. I'm going to do a rapid fire round. Pithy, short response to this, you know, dilemma that we as marketing execs face. Should startups lean on founder-led selling as long as possible, or prioritize building a scalable sales organization, even if it slows things down?
I think you have to be committed to founder-led selling until you have that first, I'm just going to say group. You can define group however big you want. Like, really established set of customers, and that your product is kind of mature enough based on a large enough number of customers, right? You can't scale it till, you can't have the repeatability and scalability until, like, you figured that out. So I think the founders have to be involved until the product is kind of mature enough to be sold. So I think it's both.
All right. I think that's about as rapid fire as Peter Ferrago gets. Cross-functional harmony among teams realistic, or should leaders just accept the tension as a natural state and learn to manage it?
I think you want healthy tension and friction, and I think you have to incentivize an organization very carefully so that there's enough collaboration and cooperation.
Couldn't agree more. Should teams stick to a go-to-market plan religiously, or should it be treated as a very broad draft and should be disposed of when reality hits?
Well, go-to-market plan can include a lot of things. I would say that you should be committed to some fundamental vision that does get expressed through go-to-market, and that you should be more religiously committed to, like, outcomes that you want, and be more flexible in how you get them.
To play upon Glengarry Glen Ross, I say ABP, always be pivoting. All right. The go-to-market strategies need a full rewrite in this new AI era we're in. Are the same fundamentals just wrapped in a different package?
This is a very good question. A short answer is, the strategic outcomes you want are the same, you know, more high quality leads, good, healthy sales cycle, all that stuff. I think that the channels and the tactics are changing. You know, how much can AI assist with different parts of that. You know, you have that's still being figured out and experimented with, but I'd say it's mostly new packaging.
Yeah, I would agree. Got to stick to the fundamentals. They're always going to be there, even though they may shift and take on a different look. If you completely blow a launch, would you consider, let's say this was one of your people, would you consider that a career killer and you'd fire them? Or would you look at it as go fast, break things, and learn and iterate?
I mean, it depends if there's real incompetence involved. You know, it depends on the mission, you know. So if it's like, hey, we're going to go experiment and there's expectations set around it, sure. Assuming I have a quality person that I want to keep investing in, it's a learning moment. That's what I would say. That's my bottom line.
I would hope the CEO and the rest of the management team would be on board, because I think that, again, especially in, again, this is not going to happen in a bigger company. You screw up in a bigger company and you lose $100 million, you're done. Goodbye. But in a startup where there's a lot more flexibility and you don't know what you don't know, and you're looking for product market fit and all these other things, I think it's important to just rise from the ashes, you know, have a phoenix-like approach. You got to do it. All right.
Do you mind if I ask you these same questions in rapid fire style?
Yes, let's go.
Should startups lean on founder-led selling as long as possible, or should they prioritize building a scalable sales model early on, even if that might slow down momentum?
This is easy for me. Founder-led, very organic, because it will take form eventually out of that.
Okay. But there's a point where it does shift, obviously.
Sure. When you get big enough, but I would say you wait until it totally breaks down where the founder can't do it anymore. Then that's when the VP of sales and the VP of marketing get together and put together what I have always referred to as a repeatable sales process.
Yeah. I think the skill in the art is figuring out when it's not scaling anymore and making that elegant transition. Okay. Yeah. Is cross-functional harmony in an organization realistic, or should execs accept this tension?
Yeah, I agree with you. Have the tension. Again, humans are messy. You are not going to have this, you know, harmony, everybody following the go-to-market plan exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's born out of, like, say, marketing and sales. They have different goals. So it's natural that they would react to things differently and want different things, right? So it comes down to the incentives, right? Okay, the next question. Do go-to-market strategies in this era of AI, do they need a full rewrite, or are they fundamentally the same and we have some different packaging because of AI?
Same fundamentals, just in a different... I think the thing that I would comment on this is that it's just going to take a very different shape, right? Mm-hmm. And we call people different things now. Like, now we have customer success. And before, that was called account management. But the reason it was renamed to customer success is because this new distribution model for software took over, which we know as SaaS, software as a service. And so before, the whole business model was around selling a bunch of seats up front, and then depending upon your systems integration team and the IT organization in that big corporation to implement those seats. The reason you have to now have to shift account management to something called customer success is because if you don't keep those subscribers around for 2 years, you lose money. So it's the same thing, but it's different. And it's different because the business model and the distribution models have changed. So in terms of a go-to-market plan, yeah, the fundamentals are still there. There's still those things you have to do. AI is definitely throwing a wrench into the machine, but it's fundamentally the same.
Totally. And my experience so far has been, I'd love to use AI to automate different things or take over different steps, but, you know, it's about trusting it enough, I think, to act autonomously. So it's like, I want it to do certain things, but it just needs supervision and tuning, and we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
The last question, a launch that's gone badly. So if one is a big failure, do you consider that a a career killer, or do you consider that like a time to learn and get better?
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, I totally think it should be a learning thing, especially in startups. There's got to be a lot of grace because you don't know what you don't know. In bigger companies, you got to be careful. You can't do it. You left out a question for me.
There,
should teams religiously execute the go-to-market deck or plan they agreed on or treat it as disposable draft? I wouldn't say a disposable draft, but I would say it's a broad outline. And it's got to be shifting constantly to the realities of what you're finding as you're executing in the marketplace.
I think it's a good, healthy exercise. It's a planning process. I guess what we're saying is we don't expect to be 100% right all the time, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't go through the planning exercise because that's its own problem, right? So,
Peter.
Yep.
How long did it take before a go-to-market plan you worked on was tossed in the trash?
Oh, my God. I did a really nice one at at a big company, we would just do it and redo it and you'd live with it, but you'd just keep
right.
adjusting.
That's what I was going to say. You iterate, yeah. You don't really throw out.
I iterated, okay. but I will say it changed pretty fast. So in theory, really quickly. And another one where I was at a startup where it was much more structured and we were launching the company and the product. I'd say my eyes were bigger than my stomach probably. And I'd say, 20% lived, the 80% either just got tossed or whatever. Yeah. So pretty fast, pretty fast.
Yeah. So this is a great one. We've talked about this already, but what was the wildest thing a founder did in a sales meeting that completely blew up your go-to-market plan?
Oh my God.
I got so many of these.
I mean, there's been some high stake, larger accounts where I've been with some pretty senior CEOs and they just like rubbed people the wrong way. But I also knew they were pushing for something. There was that risk. Like we got early in my career, we were calling on Safeway. It's a huge chain of supermarkets, at least on the West Coast. It's a humongous account. And we got thrown out of a meeting once.
Wow.
By some senior people. But we kind of knew there was that risk. So I think fortunately I have not been in situations where it messed things up per se as much as it just like it went really wrong with that particular account.
Right. Right.
But I've taken the 2x4 to the head, if that's what you mean, for sure, in the sales setting. But I don't know that it blew things up. How about you? Like you sound like you've got some concrete examples.
I don't think I do. There's just the general constant anxiety going into any customer meeting with a founder, especially a young co-founder. And it's just the randomness, just what's a random particle, what's that physics term, where you just have no idea how they're going to say something that's going to completely throw things off the rails and you have to respond.
I was at a company where you were describing kind of a young, this CEO is not talented, I will say this.
Oh,
I haven't said this person's name, but they would promise things to customers that were unrealistic. And then people who were closer to the deal would coach the person on the way in and say, dude, don't promise this. We can't do this. Or this is where we are, that account. And then it would fall apart and this person would promise everything. And it was really bad.
No, I'm actually remembering one very, very early in my career at Apple. I was in the higher education channel. So our customers were universities. And this was essentially an enterprise sale. And the sales rep for New York State, very aggressive, older gentleman, really, I know, but he was great. I mean, the guy just knocked his numbers out of the park every quarter. And I was there at a meeting with the dean of Syracuse University. So we were up in Syracuse.
Yep.
And there's a certain, there's a sweetener at the time we always threw in of tens of thousands of dollars worth of max.
Yep.
For school. At that time, there were labs. I don't even know if universities have computer labs anymore because but anyway, and there was a lot of pressure from his boss, which was, actually my boss's boss, like the head of all U.S. sales in this meeting, because again, Syracuse University was a huge, huge account. And all of a sudden, they looked at me and said, okay, Steve, it was basically out of my budget. How much was I going to give? Yeah, to throw in the sweetener. And this doesn't actually apply, but it's one of those things where you've got, quote, the CEO, who was actually the head of sales for all of North America, and very powerful guy, obviously. And, you know, the sales rep, and then here's like the little junior scrawny marketing guy just 1 year out of business school. And I had other plans for my budget. You know, there were all these things that we needed to do in terms of go to market. And so obviously I folded and collapsed in front of the dean of Syracuse because I didn't want to destroy the deal. So I think they knew what the power equation was there. Okay, Peter, I think we need to close this out. I kind of like this last one. If your go-to-market planning is a boxing match, what's your entrance song as you're coming into the ring?
You know, I think
original. It's pretty obvious.
I think a nice sting when you're walking on stage for like at a conference or something. I think When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin.
That's a great one. That's really good. Yeah. See, I'm nowhere near as creative. It would just be the Rocky song.
Oh, yeah. The Flying High Now.
That one. Yeah. So not too.
That has lyrics, by the way. That's why it says Flying High Now. Yeah, yeah.
That's
I'm not a singer,
right.
But
that.
I just sang.
Yeah, very, what is it?
Yeah,
70s
like,
groovy.
Yeah, disco's like getting strong now.
Yeah.
And then you see him running up the stairs in Philadelphia to the museum.
Yeah.
And stuff.
It's a great song, though. It's fantastic. Oh, who wouldn't want to enter the boxing ring?
Whoever scored that thing.
It's
just.
Not that song.
Yeah,
beautiful.
I'm sure I could. I do listen to a ton of music, so much music, it's hard for me to keep track, but I'm sure I could come up with many. But I like When the Levee Breaks as a standby.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to throw in a music episode, and we're just going to talk about some of our favorite music and how we've used it in marketing campaigns over the years. I think that'd be
I've spent a lot of time for videos, especially you can go into these content libraries and you can spend an inordinate amount of time listening to all kinds of music. And there are people, professional musicians, who create all kinds of music that gets used in these types of videos. You know, they sound vaguely like a hit song, you know, but they're not. Yeah. So.
All right, Peter, how about you read us out?
We want to thank you, our audience, for listening. Our editors, Lorenzo Fernandez-Kopek at Peak Bound Studio and Brian Douglas at the Creative Commonwealth, for making us sound and look great. Our marketing maven, Ian Robinson-Lambert, for helping get the word out. Julianne Bornalis for being our consulting producer. Renita Dutta for driving our marketing research and content calendar. And of course, Thomas Moyer, president of the AMA San Francisco chapter, for presenting this podcast. We'd also like to thank our sponsor, Workbox, for their support of the Misadventures in Marketing podcast.